Accession number 8736, rule number 27.
Lord Harding, tape 27. Lord Harding, can you remember the actual German surrender in Italy? I believe this came before the surrender in Europe. Am I right?
Yes, I do. It did come before. I don't remember very much about it, except that at that time I was more occupied and concerned about relationships with the Yugoslavs and the future of the political future of Venezia Giulia than I was with any problem to do with the Germans. As far as the Germans had withdrawn completely from Italy, but we were left with a difficult problem because my troops at that time were all mixed up with the Yugoslav partisans, and so the whole thing had to be sorted out, as I've just explained. And so I accept for a feeling of tremendous relief that at long last the war was over and that we had been victorious and that the Germans had been thoroughly and completely defeated. I don't remember anything other feelings, but I was very deeply concerned and involved in these discussions and arguments about the future of Venezia Giulia, and of course, and probably even more importantly, with the welfare and contentment and morale of my own troops, because the war was over. I think they naturally felt that they'd be off home pretty soon, the thing was finished, and they'd done their job, and so on. And of course there were long delays, and there was held up, and also they'd been without their families for a length of time, and if we were going to, as it appeared then, we would have to, and indeed did have to, remain in occupation of that area until the political problems of Venezia Giulia, future of Venezia Giulia and sovereignty in that part of the world had been established, there were a large number of them would be required to remain there. There were two problems. I think the most important was the welfare and the contentment of my own troops and the dealing to the Yugoslavs. We started leave camps, and we eventually got agreement to bring families out, and then there was a question of their accommodation, school, hospitalization, police, and all the rest of it. There were an enormous number of problems to deal with. But they were easier than the fighting. I mean, there was no question of people losing their lives or being shot down or murdered or anything like that.
Were you able to have celebrations when war ended? Can you remember?
I don't remember any very major celebrations. No, I think we all had a great feeling of relief. We probably had a drink too much and that sort of thing. But no, there were no sort of major. I had a victory parade in Trieste, and I timed it to coincide with May Day, because that was the big communist celebration date, and I was anxious to impress the Yugoslavs and everybody else with the strength of my forces and our ability to hold our ground there and to remain in control of that part of Italy until there was a political settlement. So I rearranged a march past of one British and one American division in Trieste, and with a view to impressing everybody, and that went all very satisfactorily. We also started having things like we organized a tattoo in the castle in Trieste. And everybody said we were mad because we arranged to have a Yugoslav male choir and an Italian army demonstration as part of the program. And they were brought into the arena in different directions, and they didn't start fighting each other, and there was no conflict. But everybody said, there you are, you're the English again, they're quite mad. Sort of, you know, mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun, like Noel Card wrote. And that all went very well, and gradually we got on to good terms. I had difficult negotiations with the Yugoslav commander. He accused me of being aggressive on one occasion because I moved a division up into the castle north of above Trieste to make sure that my troops were in a sound military position. And he accused me of being aggressive and trying to achieve an advantage by military means. And I had a meeting with him, and we discussed it all. And we were able to settle things amicably in the end. And he appeared. He came and attended the tattoo that we had. One occasion, after we had one meeting, I remember being rather annoyed because he said, at the conclusion of when we reached agreement about the disposition of our respective troops, he said, well, I suppose at the beginning of our discussion, we were all very tense, and we were both very tense and so on. And I said, oh, not at all. As a British officer, I've been used to this sort of thing from the time I joined. One got sort of feeling of personal pride, rather childish, I think, in the event. But anyway, it all gradually settled down. There were no outbreaks of violence between my troops and the Yugoslav partisans, and eventually this boundary line was established. We did get occasional troops straying across from both sides, and that had to be dealt with. But then we settled down to a sort of almost a garrison life, and we started playing games, and we had a rest camp up at Cortina for the troops, and another one on the coast where they were camps. They went on leave and they swam and they played games and so on, and was able to maintain a reasonable level of. We had vocational courses run, for example, by Rimi, with courses for potential blacksmiths or engineers and that sort of thing. So the whole thing was one of preparing everybody for demobilization and a re-entry into civil life. And how successful we were, I wouldn't know, but that's what we tried to do. We tried to keep them interested, occupied, with sport, games, activities of various kinds, and with vocational training courses.
Could I go back now, if you would bear with me, to the winter of 1944? Were the conditions very bad then? You know, you mentioned the snow and the extreme temperatures. How did the troops bear up, and how were you able to sort of fix them up regarding shelter and warm clothing and heating?
Well, yes, conditions were very bad in the Apennine. there was a lot of rain on the higher ground, the mountains, there was snow. The tracks and the routes became almost impassable, not quite. And you had to be everlastingly pushing your jeep out of the mud. And it was very inclement weather. And the Americans suffered very much because they were right in the middle of the Apennines. And, they did the best they could, I think. I don't recollect there being any serious, certainly no loss of life from exposure, but conditions were very difficult and arduous. And to illustrate my point, on one occasion, Alexander had gone off to Athens to meet the Prime Minister to discuss the future of the problems in Greece. And I was left alone. And a British Member of Parliament, I've forgotten his name now, he was Ransom's, Dick Stokes, who was a junior minister in the then government, came out and wanted to visit the troops. And on the on my staff, I had a chap called Jack Perfumo, who was later involved in all that scandalous story about women and so on. But I thought, and I still think, he was a very good chap. And that was an aberration, no doubt. But anyway, he was still a member of parliament then. He was the liaison officer at my headquarters. So, being a fellow member of parliament, I said to Dick Stokes, you got hold of him that night after dinner, and said, your colleague Dick Stokes wants to go up and visit the troops. And I told him he's got to be ready to leave before dawn, so he will be out all day. And you'll have to take charge of him, and you'll take him out with a couple of jeeps, and you'll make sure that he gets wet through, that he has to push his jeep out of the mud at least three times, and he won't bring him back after dark. And Jack Perfumo carried out his instructions to the letter. But that was an example, really, of the conditions under which the troops were operating at that time. They were severe, and they were very difficult. But I don't remember certainly no loss of life through exposure.
Did it have an effect on morale at that time?
Well, I think it did, yes. I think both the living conditions, the climatic conditions, and the fact that we were stuck. We were held up and we hadn't succeeded in getting through into the Po Valley during the winter. I think that all had a damaging effect on morale and confidence. But once the weather improved and we got on the move again and the offensive was resumed, everybody recovered. And then we were successful and so morale rose up again. You had these ups and downs.
Could I also ask you about the cooperation that existed between the three forces, the Army, Navy and the Air Force? You know, you mentioned the difficulties involved, particularly with ANZIO, in this respect. If you take the Italian campaign as a whole, how do you generally think that worked out?
Oh, I think it developed very well. I think, we had learnt quite a lot about Army air cooperation in the Western Desert. And that was projected forward into the Italian campaign. And I think that there was very close and good cooperation between the armies, the two armies, the American and the British Army, and their respective air forces. And, I think it reached a very high standard of cooperation and understanding. And the realization that the two services were interdependent, and also dependent very largely, perhaps to a lesser extent, on the cooperation with the Navy, as well. Now, I think throughout the war, inter-service cooperation developed. Perhaps not as rapidly as it ought to have done, but certainly very completely. And by the time that we're talking about, the cooperation and understanding between the three services had reached a very high standard. Mainly due to personalities and to communications. The fact that people got to understand, that the respective commanders got to know each other. I mean, the relationships, for example, between the 8th Army Commander and the commander of the Desert Air Force were very close and harmonious and effective. And that went all the way down the line.
think, when you look at these sort of parallel events in Europe, you know, Overlord I'm thinking of, do you think that made much difference to the Italian campaign? Because I'm thinking, you know, of the shape of Italy, and could not it have been possible to have had other landings if you'd had landing craft which weren't necessary in Europe? Did you ever sort of get frustrated about that?
No, I think that ideas were advanced at different times about trying to outflank the various German positions by landing from the sea. But there were no, you see, after Anzio, the landing crafts that were committed to Anzio were overdue to go to the Far East. And there was very heavy American pressure to start with to cut out the Anzio operation altogether and send the landing craft off to the Far East. I think this pressure came from Washington. Well, I'm sure it did. But then after Anzio, the landing craft were removed, they went off to the Far East, and there was no possibility of getting any more except at the expense of Avalon. And that was just not realistic to think in terms of that. So as far as we were concerned, I think we gave up any idea of any outflanking seaborne operations.
Could I ask you now, Lord Harding, about communications and sort of code-breaking during the war? Were you in at all on the ultra-secret?
Well, I can't remember precisely when, but I think it was when I went as Chief of Staff to Alexander that I was admitted to what I call the ultra list. And from then on, I was the ultra information was made available to me. And I think it was very valuable, extremely valuable. It was probably the very best intelligence that we really got. But at the same time, I think that it was very important to get corroboration with all intelligence. What you're looking for all the time is corroboration. This is my attitude and experience. You get information from one source, whether it's ultra, or whether it's air reconnaissance, or whether it's land, ground, patrol reconnaissance. And you get it, you assess it, your intelligence staff analyze it, and they try to assess its reliability and its accuracy. And all the time that you get information from one source, even from ultra, you know that it may be changed. You may get information that the army headquarters, the German army headquarters in Italy, has sent certain information back to Berlin, and that Berlin has done this or that or the other about it. But what you, until subsequently, you don't know whether those directives have been changed or modified. And so you have to, like all intelligence, you have to treat it with a grain of salt and hope for corroboration. You get corroboration from another source. I mean, take the what was it called, autumn mist, which indicated that the German plan was to withdraw altogether from Italy and to hold a European fortress based on the Alps. Well, we got that information, and it did, to a certain extent, to a large extent, influence our planning. We thought that if we pushed hard enough, the Germans would withdraw altogether, and that would be a good thing and would save us further offensives. But all the same, you wanted corroboration. And all the time, certainly in the Italian campaign, there was a feeling that Hitler was determined to hold on to every inch of ground that his forces had acquired and conquered. And it was very difficult to persuade people that all the evidence was that Hitler's in directives to his forces and their attitude was not what we thought they ought to be doing. We thought, I mean, they ought to withdraw and consolidate their defense on the last line of resistance defending Germany against invasion and attack. There's always very uncertain factors and difficult factors to do with personalities, to do with attitudes, to do with circumstances, and so on. So although Ultra was immensely valuable, it wasn't a sole answer, and it wasn't necessarily a conclusive, a final piece of intelligence. So you had to treat it like any other intelligence and, treat it for it as being very important, very significant and reliable, but not absolutely certain. And this is what happened throughout the rest of the war, but it caused Ultra, the breaking of the Axis codes and so on, was of enormous importance to the conduct of the war. But from my point of view, in the field of operations in Italy, one had to treat the information you got with a certain measure of caution, and hoping and working to try and get corroboration from other sources, from air reconnaissance, from patrol activities, and so on, and from knowledge of the personality of the various commanders involved.
When you became a recipient of Ultra, had you any idea that it existed, that there was this level, the very high level of code breaking?
No, I don't think so. I didn't, until I was told about it, I didn't know that we'd broken the German ciphers.
Who told you about it?
I can't remember.
Do you remember ever being briefed about Ultra?
Oh, yes, you were told. I can't remember who did it, but and the detail of it, but you were certainly briefed that it was to be treated with the very highest level of security and that it wasn't to be communicated to anybody else who wasn't on the Ultra list. And that it, in other words, it was to be treated as absolutely, totally secret, secure information. And so you had to be very careful about how you made use of it and how you how you justified your apparent inside knowledge of the enemy's dispositions and intentions.
To the lower levels of your staff?
To the lower levels, yes. It demanded a very high degree, I suppose, you would call it now, of discretion in handling that particular information. And that was absolutely right, because if any idea or hint had got back to the Axis forces that ciphers had been broken, that signals were being interpreted and used, they would have taken action accordingly. So it was terribly important to keep it as absolutely secret and to make certain that the information was used with the utmost discretion.
So who would have been responsible for passing on those signals to you? Did you have a special person who took charge of it?
Honestly, I'm sorry, I don't remember. I don't remember what the detailed organization was for deciphering and the handling of the information.
You would have been given a written message, would you?
I would be either verbal or written, yes. And that would be done through our own intelligence staff, which was then headed by a chap called Terence Airy.
Can you remember any particular signals or bits of information which proved vital with Ultra?
No. I'm sorry, no, I don't think I can. I would be... drawing too much on my imagination if I told you that I was. I did.
So what contribution do you think it made to the war?
Oh, I think it made... I think it made an all-important contribution. I think it was perhaps not decisive, but it was a major factor, a really major factor, probably the most outstanding factor in the conduct of the various campaigns.
Was it useful in letting you know how the resources of the enemy, how what situation was there?
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, you got detailed information about the enemy's order of battle, about the orders and directives to their various commanders. Oh, yes, it gave you a complete picture of the enemy's layout and of his plans. And sometimes they were changed, but by and large it proved to be what they did. Sometimes they changed their plans and made different dispositions, different deployments, and so on. But no, it gave you a clear picture of the enemy's order of the battle, his deployment, his intentions, and his plans. And that was of inestimable value.
In reverse, yes.
In reverse, of course, this need for corroboration of what appears to be self-evident is a very important element, factor, in the maintenance of security. Because people get inclined to think that what is common knowledge within their own forces can be talked about freely, forgetting the fact that the enemy all the time is looking for corroboration. I mean, you take, say, the situation in Cairo, GHQ, and say you get two or three senior staff officers from GHQ having a drink together in Shepherd's Bar and talking freely about what, to them, was common knowledge. But maybe there was a barman or somebody listening for whom it provided corroboration. And therefore, all talk is dangerous. And that establishes that fact. So in reverse, it's terribly important to realize that although things may be thought to be common knowledge about future plans and intentions and activities and so on, it's very insecure. It's a breach of security to talk about them. And that is important.